Yes, Father.
Father, when we were having coffee, Ms. Linda asked a question, and I wanted to go ahead and ask it in a different way. You've shown us the beautiful island, and you're a monk on this beautiful island. And I think in American thought process, this could be seen as a very narcissistic, kind of selfish kind of thing. You know, you're out in the middle of the most beautiful environment praying while the rest of the world is, you know, struggling along. And I'd like you just to comment on, because I think that's a very common perception I've encountered about monasticism, and I thought it'd be a good thing for you to talk about.
Yes, we were having coffee, trying to keep myself awake. And Elizabeth, it's so strange to think of you as Linda. In my mind, you're Elizabeth. Because that's how we interact. It's a pilgrimage, you know, and we call ourselves with our names, so I'm stuck with them. Has asked the question, and actually I have asked Father to allow me not to answer it because I wanted you all to ask the question, in a way. I'm aware this is something that a lot of people think in the West about monasticism. Because as long as you're not part of that life, you can project things on it. And I can tell you things look precisely the same from a monastic's point of view when you look into a family. You know, what are you talking about? You're married. You've got a beautiful wife. You go home and you enjoy your time. Glory be to God, you know. You consume your marriage, so to say. You have these beautiful kids that give you so much joy, and it feels like heaven, you know, the perfect American ad for the perfect American family. Thank God I'm also a priest. So from confession, I know that there's a lot of things hiding behind that beautiful image, and I know those little angels can be little angels but of a different color. And I know more just because I have met married people in confession. And that's why I wanted you to ask the question now, because you, your only chance to know more about monasticism in a real way is to interact with monastics. And I do encourage you, I have no awareness if there are any monasteries around you, do go and visit them. Do go and just try to spend a few days or a week, once a year or twice a year with them, so that you learn about each other and you learn from each other. In many ways, this question, what is monasticism useful for, which, by the way, was the question that communists asked, and it's behind the reasoning why they closed down the monasteries. They considered monks to be useless to their society, so they had to be terminated. They didn't generate profit, basically. This question is very much related to something else we discussed during our coffee, which is, where are the black people in the Orthodox Church? Where are the Asian people in the Orthodox Church? This whole idea of diversity seems to be something that Americans are very much scared about. But diversity has always been the foundation of the Orthodox Church. In some ways, this is what defines us. There has never been a time in our history when we tried to go somewhere and impose our culture, the way, for instance, the Roman Church has done in a lot of places in the past. That we have never had, at least canonically, we should not have, a language we impose upon other people, a culture we impose upon other people. We don't have a Russian church. We don't have a Greek church. We have the Orthodox Church in Russia and the Orthodox Church in Greece. These are the correct terms, the canonical ways to refer to these local churches. Not the Romanian church, but the Orthodox Church in Romania, because it just happens to be in Romania. Christ's salvation is available to all of us, and we, each of us, have our own paths. Rather than being afraid because we have different ways of worshipping or praying, being afraid because we have different styles of iconography or different languages, Orthodoxy has always embraced that. in the first centuries, if you look at the styles of icons that were available throughout Christendom, they feel immensely richer than what we have today, although today we have the financial means and the knowledge to be able to do that. But instead of being open to our own culture, to what's authentic within ourselves, we have decided for some reason to just amputate ourselves, amputate our traditions, and just choose. In order to be Orthodox, you have to be Russian or you have to be Greek. In order for an icon to be a proper icon, it has to be Byzantine style or Russian style. But the problem there is that this amputation of our culture, this amputation of our tradition, actually goes back to a subtle amputation of who we are as human beings. It's almost like saying you have to be a certain way in order to be accessible to Christ. In order to be saved, you have to look a certain way, behave a certain way, pray a certain way, speak a certain language, worship with certain icons around you, and only then maybe you can be saved. But what you see really, and that's why I'm here, what you see really is that you have, let's only talk about monks, because I know monks. You have holy monks who lived in big monasteries like on Iona. You have monks who lived in smaller communities like those nuns in the cave, you know, in the bigger cave. Then you have hermits who live entirely by themselves. They may live in a cave, they may live in a small building. Some of them in Wales lived in basically fountains. They would just dig a hole and live in the hole. And so that water wouldn't just drown them, they would dig the hole down like that and then do it a bit like that. So that if it rained and water got inside, they just hid in that bubble. You have monks who lived in holes, in caves, in monasteries, on towers. Think of the Syrian tradition of all those beautiful saints who just built towers and they lived their entire lives up on a tower. Go to Thessaloniki and you will see the full, incorrupt relics of St. David of Thessaloniki, another monk who lived in a tree. He just climbed in a tree and said, I'm not going down. This is where God wants me. This is where I'm going to be saved. And that was perfectly acceptable because they recognized that when the Spirit works, it fits no pattern. There's no recipe. There's no magical formula. But because we have lost faith, and I'm convinced that's what at the bottom of it all, our faith is so frail and we are so afraid, we need recipes. We need the certainty, the comfort of knowing that in order to bake a cookie, I need this amount of sugar, this amount of flour, and some dry fruit or whatever else you need. I have no idea. I imagine. But once you have a recipe, you have the comfort that, you know, you're doing things right, kind of. But that's not the case with our salvation. It's all madness. Because it's all unique to you alone. Of course, we have the experience of the church. We have 2,000 years filled with thousands and thousands of wonderfully mad holy men and holy women. But they are not there to give us formulas or recipes. They are there to tell us, look what I did, and it worked for me. So if your path kind of looks like mine, don't be afraid. Just follow it. That's like the larger picture. If you reduce that to monasticism, the original question, our prayers differ from one person to another. And what God wants of us differs from one person to another. He may want you to build a mission somewhere that, I don't know, feeds the poor in your city. He may want some of you, maybe Elizabeth, to go out and speak to the black population around you. He may need someone like, I understand you have had a guest from the St. Elizabeth Monastery in Minsk. I've not met them, but if they've been here, I do hope you were generous and supported them, because they do a wonderful thing. A wonderful thing. But that is their vocation. There are others for whom the vocation is to just disappear. Not because you are running away from the world, but because you are running away towards something. And the only way that your path can get you there is to be alone with that presence. I don't know how else to explain it. There are people for whom prayer is only alive when they are entirely alone. And you should not look down upon them or with envy or any sort of negative feeling, because that is very difficult to do. It's not an easy life to have, and it comes with very difficult temptations. But their purpose, the beauty of their purpose in your lives, is that it is so subtle and so humble that you don't know that they have a purpose. You wonder why they exist and you think that they are useless. But when you cross the street and that car just misses you by a centimeter, somebody somewhere, on a mountain, on a hill, in a cave, or in a skit of a monastery, is praying for the world. When you go through an accident and you wonder, oh my God, how did I survive that? Somebody somewhere who has sacrificed family life, a career, and all the comforts of living in the world in order to be able to pray as much as possible was praying. When somebody you love just finds out that they have cancer, when somebody you love just has a bout of depression and an attempt to commit suicide, when you yourself fight a temptation, somebody somewhere unknown to you is praying for you. And in a way, I am convinced to my bones that today we need monasticism more than ever, because we all need these silent warriors. Not me. I mean, look at me. I'm here speaking to you in the first week of Lent instead of being in a cave somewhere. But I have met people like that. I have seen people like that. And I'm here to give witness that they do exist. We need them more than ever. There's a way in which you, people in the world, help the world by staying on the surface somehow. You work horizontally even. You go to your right, you go to your left, you feed the poor, you visit the sick, you create a mission, you speak to that person, you help a monk establish a monastery. It's a way in which you help from person to person, like a network that just kind of embraces the earth. What monks and nuns do, again, proper monks and proper nuns, not me, they don't work on the surface. They don't work horizontally. They go deep down. They find one place and they don't move. And they may meet no one. Saint Sisoas the Great, who lived in the 300s in the Egyptian desert, lived in the same cave for 72 years. Saint Isaac the Syrian, the great Isaac the Syrian, lived in his own cell for so long, and he cried so much that he went blind from his tears. These people change the DNA of our humanity. They may never meet you, but they just change our blood. It's a different kind of prayer that helps you in your own outreach in the world. Don't trick yourself to think you are doing everything on your own. Don't trick yourself that if you have the strength to work, to make the money, to help the poor, you are doing it all alone, unconnected with these monastics. Because they are the ones who give you the strength. And they are the ones who send your way the people who can help you. Don't allow pride and this demon of separation that seems to overtake the world today. Don't allow these walls that we build between each other as persons to make you think that we are somehow different or cut away from each other. We are all one being. And my sin affects all of you. And my prayer affects all of you. And similarly, when I sin, you are all guilty to some degree because you have failed to pray for me. And when I succeed in my prayer, I know it's not because of me. I know it's because somebody, somewhere, is blessing me, even if I've never met them. We are so much together in this thing. Don't allow anyone or anything to break this unity. Because the minute we are broken, that's the minute we are lost. I'm not like him, you know, as the Pharisee said. I'm so much better. And that's the minute he lost it all. Because that's the minute when he built the wall. I'm not like him. It's a very Protestant way of thinking of the world. And I say that with love. Because I have no reason not to love Protestant people. I've met wonderful people in those churches. But there is a way there, a way of thinking, a thought process, where you define yourself as a Christian by excluding those who don't fit your understanding of what a Christian is. You define yourself by cutting chunks away. And that's why, you know, Protestant churches splinter so much and they keep on breaking. The church, the true church, teaches us that the way to define ourselves is not to exclude people, but to enlarge our own humanity by including as many people as we can. And how do you do that? By loving them. By just loving every single human being around you. Black or white or purple or green, you know, in love with men or women or goats or bunnies, it's completely irrelevant. If he or she is still alive, there still is hope. And if God put him or her before you, your only responsibility is to pray and to love. And you can do that as a married man or a married woman in a certain way. And you can do that as a monk or a nun in a different way. It's still prayer. It's still love.
Is there a special sense of desire to connect with God when one is already living?
Perhaps maybe Elizabeth would be better to answer that. I'm not going to put her on the spot. So I will give... because I've never been a pilgrim to the Isles. That has been my home since the moment I said yes to that church. But they do talk about the thin places of the Isles. Iona is seen, understood as a thin place, a place where these walls that we create between ourselves and God are so refined, almost transparent, that they go away. There's a sense of a more abrupt kind of spirituality. You can't really be very complex in those islands if you want to survive. basically. And the reality is that nothing is complex and nothing is difficult. The more sophisticated one's theology is, the more probable it is that that theology is rubbish anyway. My grandmothers, I mean, one of them couldn't read or couldn't write. And I'm convinced she's floating about in heaven. How did she pray? What was her theology? How do you pray? I've actually done that. I've done that as an exercise. I treat, by the grace of God and with the blessing of my spiritual father, he allows me to do this for chunks of time, like a month or a Lent, to basically experiment with prayer or different things. And I remember for a long time, I asked myself, how did my grandmother pray without using her eyes to read? And I just stopped reading anything. Anything. Try to do that for a week. And you'll see how dependent, utterly dependent we are on the written word. And on other people's words, basically. And how lazy we have become in our attempts to take those words, which we should take.